You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world. And now, innovation thought leader and your super fly host, Tamara Kleinberg.
Tamara here on Inside Launch Street. Hey, the best way to describe this interview, I think, is fascinating. I interviewed Dr. Andrea J. Simon, PhD, also known as Andy. She's an international leader in the emerging field of corporate anthropology. What is that, you ask? We're going to dig in and find out. She is also an Axon Best Business Book of 2017 winning author for On the Brink, A Fresh Lens to Take Your Business to New Heights, and the founder of Simon Associates Management Consultants. We explored how we should think of our businesses as small-scale societies, how to avoid the challenges of the herd, which I think many of us fall into and don't even realize it, and turning everyday observations into profound innovation. Let's get this one started. Andrea, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm very much looking forward to our conversation.
Well, as we were talking, Tamara, as we got started, it sounds like you are really into ethnography and anthropology, and I have a hunch your listeners might be as well.
Well, I, you know, clearly sought you out and looked at your stuff, so it's going to be pretty exciting. But before we kind of dig into a lot of the meat of it, let's start with kind of what is corporate anthropology anyway? I'm not sure everyone knows what that is yet.
Well, you know, just a bit of context. When I started my business right after 9/11, I was before that an executive in banks and executive in healthcare, and I was very interested in launching a business that could bring the tools of anthropology to help them in some fashion. And my PR firm said, "You're a corporate anthropologist who helps companies change." And I went, bingo. But I never got hired at the beginning for corporate anthropology because no one had a clue what corporate anthropology was. So Your question is perfect. And it's become, I'm actually working on a blog about the coming of age of corporate anthropology because Ford has anthropologists and Steelcase has anthropologists and Microsoft has anthropologists and Intel has anthropologists. And all of a sudden, the entire user experience world is looking for corporate anthropologists. So what it is? Anthropology is very much a wonderful social science approach to studying our society and how humans organize themselves, what kind of ways in which they tell stories to better understand what they believe and value. Remember, humans are creative, symbolic creatures. And we live in groups, and we organize those cultures in groups in order to get things done and also to pass the traditions down to the next generation. We're very complicated. We have belief systems and religions, and we formalize them, and we work in companies. And one interview I was doing asked me, "I thought you study small-scale societies." And I said, "What makes you think a business is in a small-scale society?" So what we're basically doing is applying a methodology developed perhaps elsewhere on Samoa to a company near you, which looks a lot like an island called Samoa. And so what we are really interested in is how can we see, feel, and think about what you're doing with fresh eyes and in the process help you do better. So our job is to take observation and turn it into innovation.
So fascinating to me. And I'm wondering if this fits together and tell me if I'm off on a wrong track. You know, I always talk about how organizations and innovation is a lot like an organism, right? It's either growing or dying. And really there's no such thing as stagnant. And we've got to figure out like which side of that we're actually on. Is that part of that when you think about anthropology and, you know, I love that what you said about business being a small scale society. Is that part of it of understanding kind of like where we're headed, where we are, where we're headed, what our behaviors are?
Well, often we get hired because the culture in an organization has a very strong anchor to the way we've always done it, because that's the most comfortable place for people, for humans to be. They really like the habits of everyday living, and the brain hates us and it hates change. And so, you know, companies, small scale companies, big complex ones, global ones, find themselves often stalled where the world and the business around them is changing. Their clients are changing. Roll-ups are making it a different competitive market. The new employees are millennials and they do things differently. But the anchor to the way we've always done it holds them back. And stability is gone. The speed of change is like a hockey stick. It's fast. But humans aren't very good at responding quickly until they have a crisis or create one. So back to your question, most companies would be perfectly happy if every day was like yesterday. They understood the buyer's journey. I mean, I had a client, a prospective client not long ago called me, and everything we talked about was no but. Everything was not good, but not bad, and didn't know what he wanted to do. And I said, I don't think I can help you, because until you're ready to let go of the way we do things today, it's very hard to change to adapt to the world that's coming fast. Now, the fast coming world is about us everywhere. And so, you know, a couple of common challenges that we get asked about and work with is we have great sales guys, but nobody's answering the phone anymore because the folks they used to talk to retired, and the new folks answering the phone are 30 somethings and they don't talk on the phone. And so you can get angry at the customer. And that happens all too often, or you can begin to see that those 30-somethings shop differently, even if they're buying a fabrication of metal for a particular part. They go online and they search. And so we have this tension today that's really mounting quickly between the anchor, the proof that this is what we've always done, it must be sacred, therefore we must do it again. And the habits take over and our beliefs become stronger and stronger as others are pulling us forward to someplace new, unknown, and very scary because we don't really like ambiguity. And humans are now facing a tremendous amount of, I don't know what they're doing. I don't know why they're doing it that way. They work for us, but can't they do it the way we've always done it? It's a very great time for telling great stories.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I was just thinking, as you were saying that, I was thinking, wow, you know, it's fascinating to me. I just had this recent experience with my 8-year-old who we were on vacation and we had cable. We don't have cable at home. We do Netflix, HBO, everything online, basically. And I mean, we barely even have a TV. And we went on vacation and we had cable and they got to watch Cartoon Network and commercials. And they were so mad at the commercials. And I remember thinking, oh man, when I was a kid, that's how you learned about new products. Were commercials. Like, it's totally changed. And it actually translated into, we went to the stores, school's about to start, and we were going down the aisle, and I said, oh, do you want these shoes? These are the ones from the commercial. And he turned to me and he said, no kidding. He said, oh, I don't want those. Those were in those commercials, and those were getting in the way of my show. And I was like, oh my goodness. Like, it's just to what you're saying about, like, we're holding on to these anchors, like, this is how we do it. Yes. And yet the customer, the behaviors of the society that we're in have actually changed. So I want to go back to, you had said, turning observation into innovation, which is such a powerful statement for all you launch shooters out there listening to pay attention to. How do you do that? How do you take corporate anthropology and help turn observation into innovation?
Let's see. Easiest way to describe it is to tell a few stories and then come back to the process. I try not to be too academic or abstract, because that always tends to put people off. So let's take this, let's make the complex simple and the stuffy accessible in storytelling. I do a lot of workshops. I had 50 of them to do across the country in Canada and Mexico this year. And in one group, there's a story in my book, Jim Riley goes back and says, I'm going to go exploring. I teach people how to see with fresh eyes, and often it's in their own companies. They say, go back. When was the last time you sat on the customer service phone? And what could you learn if you did? Be an anthropologist for a little while. And so Jim did. And he then called and he said, oh my gosh, I spent 2 hours listening to the telephone calls coming through. And during those 2 hours, Susie never said anything but, no, I'm sorry, we don't do that. No, I'm sorry, we don't do that.
That's
no,
fun for
I'm
the
sorry,
customer.
We don't do that. Now, he said, after 2 hours, I said to her, I mean, you said to me, that's cute, but he was getting more and more agitated because he said to her, how come you never say anything but we don't do that? She said, because you told me we don't do that. At which point he said, well, we can do all of that. She said, I spend my entire day telling people what we don't do because they rarely call for what we do do. So all of a sudden, he had observations that he turned into a 40% growth in his business, call that innovation, doing things that people were asking for instead of selling a factory that manufactured wonderful chain and great snow chain for the snow tires. And all the things that they did, they could do lots more if only they stopped thinking factory out instead of customer in. And so he was a perfect case study, and we've worked with him since then because he took all of his factory from China and brought it to Mississippi. And part of this is discovery, but discoverers also have to be deliverers. And so part of it is, how do I take the observations that he's listening to and then stop and say, my goodness, I can do that. How do I do it? And how do I do it in a way that's innovative so that I'm not just in a very bloody red ocean of competition looking just like others? And so that's how we work on that stuff. Please, Tamara.
Yeah, so if I hear you right, though, and I think what's so important in what you're saying in those observations is it wasn't just, correct me if I'm wrong, it wasn't just, how do I make customer service better? Let me give, you know, Susie a better script. It's, wow, let me listen to what the customers are really telling us by asking these questions and calling in with these issues. And then let's turn that into new products, services, processes, et cetera.
So let me take Jim's case. I could add a bunch of others, but let's go up a little bit in terms of how a listener might think about it themselves. When was the last time you spent a day in the life of a customer? Really? Call them, say, I want to go hang out and watch how you're doing things and getting things done. And what could you actually observe if you went out there to see what they were really doing, not what they were telling you? Because people will tell you what they think you want to hear.
Yeah.
And then you watch them actually doing it and had nothing to do with it at all. You know, in the early days of buying things online, we used to put up cameras and ask people, how will you buy this on this website? And they would tell you. And then we would watch them. And the video would capture how they actually did it, which had nothing to do with what they said.
Right.
And so it's a very important for listeners, though. If you've never spent a day in the life of a customer, you don't have to spend the whole day. Just spend enough time to become sensitized to what their pain points are, their go-arounds, where you could add value. And a second thing you can do is, you know, if you want to sit on the phone and listen to the calls coming through, we had somebody who actually created a "we don't do it" person to handle all the calls coming in that we don't do. It was interesting. But we had one client, and they were in a house wrap business. They're also a case study in our book. But they said, we don't sell in the South or Southwest. They don't need the product. And so I go and I do my exploring, and we had 60 emails in a month from the South and Southwest. And so the president of the company says to me, well, what do they need it for? And I'm laughing. I said, so here we have people coming and asking for your product. Because you don't think they need it, you're going to delete them. why don't we find out what they're asking for? You're laughing.
Right.
But every situation is right in front of you. We work with a hospital, and their physicians had sort of maxed out. There were only so many women in the market. They had 80% of the women or whatever it was. And I went out with one of our marketing folks, and he came back and said, oh, my gosh, men don't use doctors. They use emergency rooms. They don't stay compliant with their medication. They die 10 years earlier. Men were a huge possibility. By observing the fact that his own father had no doctor to go to when he got sick, but was insured. And so it wasn't an insurance or non-insurance issue. It was no doctor. And then you found out that almost half the men don't have a primary care doctor or any relationship with them. Wow. You know, huge opportunity. Cleveland Clinic has 5,000 men come in once a year for their annual physicals. They open up a whole men's clinic just to handle the unmet needs of what you could observe. So part of this, it's changing a mind from this is who our customer is, this is our market space, to go explore and begin to see what possibilities there are. And they're usually all around you.
You know, I love that you're talking about this. And I'll just, you know, share this short story. This is from years ago. I used to love doing customer ethnographies when I did new product development. And one of the ones, and this is exactly what you're saying, I'll never forget this. We, you know, looked at the screener for the, you know, the criteria screener for the woman. And it was like, yes, I eat healthy. I live a healthy lifestyle. We were looking at healthy cereals. You know, health is a priority for me. So then we went to her house and had breakfast with her. And she was talking to us about how healthy she was. And there's a deep fryer on the kitchen counter. And she's pouring sugar onto her Cheerios. And I'm looking at her going, but the reality is, kind of to your point, it's not that she lied. It's that that's what she perceives herself to be, but what she was doing was completely different. And the power of observation, if you're talking about, is so much greater than what people just tell you.
Well, you know, I just had an article published on why we lie. And to your point, she really didn't lie.
No.
She told you truth of something, but it wasn't necessarily relevant. I'm not sure she even saw herself putting the sugar on her cereal. The habit took over, and she went about it in a very habitual way without probably thinking that I started doing this when I was five, and I haven't stopped. But that's where culture comes in, and I bet you did the same ethnographies I remember, where we watched them. The guys would say, I eat healthy, and they'd stop at Dunkin' Donuts
right.
and pick them up on the way.
Right? Totally, yeah.
Now, nobody would say to you, I'm not a healthy person, or yeah. I don't do it well. And so you have this disconnect. The reason ethnography is so powerful is that it allows you to see what people can't really tell you. But I will also tell you that some of the challenges for corporate anthropologists today are multiple. We're finally getting into the C-suite, and they're finally getting to be a part of user experience research. But in all too many cases, they're the box that's checked off, did it, as opposed to what did you really see? And I was at one conference, and they were all frustrated because the C-suite didn't hear the insights that they came up with. And then I had a client who we were working with, and they had ethnography done, and they basically discounted everything that the observers observed. Huh. And so I share that with you because it isn't so simple. I mean, you've done ethnography. Okay. Part of it is that I find I didn't sell myself as an anthropologist. I sold myself on somebody who could help companies change. Now, I was EVP of a bank. I helped it really adapt to new regulations and deregulations. And I was SVP of a savings bank. I had to buy a whole new distribution system, even get rid of passbooks. I came into business with an academic background, but with also a business experience. And I'm finding that unless you can craft this in a way that someone in the C-suite can see it also, which then takes you down to the, is your data talking to you? Can you hear it? And that's why when I go out in the field, the first thing I do with a client is I take them with me. I said, you got to come and listen with me. And we hear different things.
Yeah.
And so I had one client, he went out, and every one of his clients said things like, Mark, can't you do it any faster? And Mark would say to him, but you give me the specs, and I built it to your specs. Yeah, but can't you do it any faster? And I said to him, how come, you know, you want it faster? He said, well, speed is my competitive advantage. And we'd walk out, and I say to Mark, speed is his competitive advantage. He said, I've never even seen his product used. He gives me the specs and I build his batteries. And that disconnect between what the customer really needs instead of what you think they need is really where the gap is for ethnographers to play a role that could help business people understand what they are seeing differently. We took him all over the place. I said, you got to come with me. You got to see how it's actually done, how they're building the products, how it's being used. And stop thinking that what you do is fulfill their specifications. One guy said it so clearly, Mark, you know more about this than we do. Can't you teach our guys how to do better? He said, would you give me the specs and I build your battery? And I say that tongue in cheek. Mark and I are still good friends. But he really had a hard, his guys had a hard time. Not simply selling. So my last little story about listening differently. I gave a workshop in Chicago, and a fellow from Ohio sent his head of sales to it. And I was sort of honored. But we were listening to each other, and he said to me, oh, my gosh, I was out with my sales guys, and we sell a patented foam insulation. And the sales process was just lovely. But the client kept saying, what if? Could you? How about? What if? He said he must have said what if a dozen times, and neither me nor the sales guy ever listened. And so we just shut down. We were getting our commission. We got the product sold. But what we could have done is solve his unmet needs. And that would have been a huge revenue generator. So he went back to Ohio and created the what if sales process. He said, and now we don't go out to sell something, a product. We go out to listen to their problems. And it was just one of those ahas, like, yeah, that's what it's about. You got to observe and listen differently.
So I have so many questions swimming around. So I'm going to back up and ask a bigger one first and then dig in. And that is, you know, you had mentioned that, you know, you help people change, companies change. What pitfalls or what situations are they in when they call you? If I'm not at the company that's got a corporate anthropologist on staff and it's really front and center, which is unfortunately still, I would say, probably a large portion, what is it that sparks the, oh, I need to call Andy, I need to get some of this skill into my organization?
It's a slow process because most of the time they're two problems happening. On the one hand, they're going to tweak and improve efficiencies and get a better sales guy and try and get a different sales approach and work within the market space that they know. So we go through that. Then they call because that's all going nowhere. And either they've read a book, they've been introduced to me by someone, they saw me in a workshop. I love the workshops because it makes it real. Yeah. And they call typically with that pain point. They're not quite a crisis, but they're getting close. And the crisis in the mind is really what's the incentive for it. So that they call because they've had 3 years of no growth. Or they call because I heard you can help us. We sell, this is, you know, prospective guy, we sell mats for industrial locations where people stand all the time. And our market shares remain the same. The market isn't growing. And we do this really well. Help. And I it was a very interesting discussion about, you know, what's coming next? Because if robots are coming, will anybody be standing on your mats at all? Mm. He said, you know, I'm That's seeing some robots question. Happening. Yeah. So you come in stalled. We had a client who had an award-winning product. They had a water filler station, award-winning. It wasn't selling at all. So they tried to sell it through their old manufacturer's reps. But water fountains were by code, and filler stations that went on top of them weren't. So who was going to spend some more money to put a filler station on? Until a college bought 50 of them. And the purpose of the filler stations was to eliminate the sale of plastic water bottles. And so we worked with them and worked with them. And then finally, one of the groups that we were working with had the aha moment to say, this isn't about filling the station. It's about filling a bottle. It's about killing a bottle.
Oh, wow.
And that little sentence was a transformative one. Now, I must tell you, he said it. My process got him to that point. Yeah. But he had everyone then shift in a moment. But they had to change their whole marketing strategy, their whole market strategy to people who wanted to kill the bottle, not fill the bottle. They had to take it away from their manufacturer's reps and hire 9 new salespeople to go out into college campuses. And then as it picked up momentum, they began to see how they had failed to see what was right in front of them. It represents 25% of a $700 million company in their sales now, but it was zero when we started to work with them. And they typically come when they simply can't figure out how to get out of their own way and what's coming next and can you help me? So that's what we do.
I think the power in the story that you just shared, and for launch readers out there, I mean, my jaw is a little bit to the floor, so I'm going to try to pick it up before I finish my statement. But, you know, it's how we do things today, yesterday and today, is not how we should be doing them tomorrow. And the marketplace is changing. So the conversation or the question that we really have to ask ourselves is, are we going to solve today's problems? Like, how do I sell more mats, or how do I sell more bottles, fill the bottles? Or are we going to move with our marketplace and solve tomorrow's problems? And that sounds like what you did with these groups by incorporating these tools that we've been talking about.
And they can as well, because I often want them to become amateur anthropologists, get out of their offices and start seeing their own customers and potential customers with fresh eyes. Because if your next generation is changing, so we had a conversation with a paint manufacturer and they went in a different direction, but the conversation was so telling about why they come in. He sells paint through Home Depot and his market are boomers. And this sounds great, except boomers aren't painting their houses the way they used to. Need I say more?
Yeah, I mean, done. It's not going to work.
And I mean, really? And so it's sort of like, okay, what date are we going to change our strategy to begin to better understand the next generation? I love what's going on because this is the lowest home ownership in the U.S. since 1965. Only 69% of Americans own homes. So anything that's related to the home has changed. And then millennials are all living in rental apartments, and that's a huge industry. But that means everything we're doing has to change and think about it differently there. So it's so our job is, when you say, hey, what are the pitfalls that they come to us to try and solve? Often, all too often, the market's changing, things are changing, and they sit inside wondering how come sales are stalled or dropping. And so that's that kind of, I don't know what I'm doing, can you help me? And it doesn't take long to take them exploring when they have an epiphany and it goes, oh, I missed the whole thing. And off they go.
I tell you what, I would like to see you work with malls across America, because I had to go the other day, and I avoid it, right? I shop on Amazon, Zappos, like any, I don't even go to the grocery store anymore. I use Instacart for all my deliveries, and I love it. Love it all. But it was so fascinating to me. I was at the mall the other day, and, you know, I think much like you, I just like to sit and observe people. It's just fascinating to me to watch the world around me. And so I kind of did a couple laps in the mall, and the thing that struck me was, first of all, 95% of the stores were fully staffed and fully empty.
Yep.
The only three stores, and I wouldn't even call them stores, that were busy was Apple. Mm-hmm. They've kind of cracked the code on experience from day one. And these other two that I didn't even know were in the mall until recently, Tesla had a location inside the mall, and Peloton, the bicycles, the spinning bikes. So I don't have either of those, but they were swamped with people, and everything else was dead. Yep. And I thought, my gosh, this is a great example of, like, some people have got it. They figured it out. It's not the mall that's dead. It's the going to the mall as a destination to shop that's dead. We still want to go places. So I really wish that you could work with some malls and get that nailed down, because I want to go to the mall, but there's no reason for me to go.
But think about it. I mean, there was a story yesterday in Financial Times about the Hudson Valley Mall up in the Kingston area that thrived when IBM was up there with 7,000 employees. Mm. And over time, IBM has pulled out. The employees have also. The Macy's and the JCPenney's have closed. And we now have actually it was a new owner taking it over, because the creditors had lost all their money on it. And now we had space. But humans, people now, like you and I, don't have the same time. I grew up in the retail business, and it was located right by Subway in Manhattan, and it was a fabulous location, but people moved by it, and you can almost pattern your sales by their shopping movements. But that's gone.
Yeah.
And nobody has either the time or the interest to wander through and observe. And even if they do, they often will buy on their iPhone while they're watching that thing that they just tried on and see where they can get the same thing for less. And so the nature of purchasing and shopping, and then you buy things online and you send it back.
Yeah.
And returns on Zappos are free. And so there's a whole, I mean, apartments in New York have the biggest problem with the packages delivered from Amazon, because they have to set up a whole new system so people can have their own keys
to
take their packages out.
To receive the packages, yeah.
To receive it. And the poor doorman is spending his day with packages. So everything is changing. You love to hang out, and I do as well. I keep wondering where the mall owners were when things were moving.
Right. They should be walking on the mall like we are.
Absolutely. Now, having said that, though, I mean, space has purpose. And, you know, there are what's one of the things that I was reading about was how the restaurants have replaced the anchors, because people are eating out, and they're eating out lots more. Mm-hmm. And there's looking for diversity in where to eat and so forth. So a lot of the restaurants have become anchors very differently than the anchors have. The question is, what else are you going to buy there? And the Apple experiential, you know, humans are experiential. So the question is, what else can you experience? And I was at one place, I think in Kansas City, and they had taken a whole big space and turned it into an upscale bowling alley, pool table, and bar.
Sounds fun.
Well, it was designed to have multiple purposes throughout the day for different market segments. And make it classy, leather couches around the bowling alleys, you know, pool tables and ping pong. It was very interesting to see how they were trying to take space and make it experientially valuable, when just having bowling alleys had, you know, a whole different experience to it. So, and they had a meeting room, which is where we were meeting in there. But it was a class act, and it was doing quite well. But it was innovative. So going back to your observation to innovation, it would be really cool to take one of those malls and test a bunch of things with the potential users creating it for you. You know, what would millennials do, right?
That would be amazing. And, you know, this all goes back to, and I hope those of you listening are taking some serious notes here about the power of observation and seeing things a little bit differently. I think as you said it, Andy, with fresh eyes, I think we all get jaded. When you start to hear the same thing over and over again, you almost start to tune it out. So we got to back up, and we've got to really, to what Andy's saying, we've got to open our eyes, have a fresh perspective, and go observe what's happening around us, because it's, I don't want to say obvious, like it's duh, but it's happening and it's there, right? And we're missing it because we're so internally focused, whether that's doing our job, the day-to-day of it, the numbers we were told to meet, you know, fill in the blank. So I want to switch gears a little bit just in the essence of times, because there's a couple things I wanted to make sure to ask you about that I think are important. And maybe it all kind of fits together anyway, but one of them is something that you had said that really struck me, which was, you talked about avoiding the challenges of the herd. Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, what that is, and then we can dig into how to avoid it?
Oh, how timely that is. Humans are most comfortable when they are in a herd. We're pretty sophisticated primates, but if you've noticed, we like to hang out with others like us. We can call it a tribe or a culture, but we are much more comfortable not being outliers, soloists, but in the orchestra itself. And I can use any one of a number of metaphors, but the herd poses a challenge because this kind of group speak pulls people into being alike as opposed to being outliers. And the challenge when you're going through change is that most people will immediately put up hurdles, as the CEO says, we must change. We have to find a new market space, or we're going to really rethink the way our sales folks operate. And they'll immediately say, I don't understand what he's talking about. Cognitive hurdle is it's the easiest one. And they'll go right back to what they've always done, because that's where others are doing the same and they are all most comfortable. And the second one is, I'm not motivated to do this. Humans have no motivation to change until you have a crisis. You know, you have an emergency and then I'll take care of myself. Being healthy all the time, not sure. The third one is resources. Oh my gosh, I don't have any staff for this. I don't have any time for this. What does he really want me to do? What does she want me to do? The herd makes them feel much more comfortable that they can abort this more easily, and they will share each other's reasons why they shouldn't do it. And the last one is politics. Power invariably creates a wonderful environment where it's you play to the power and you ignore the outliers who are trying to do something. The herd, the anchors that hold you back, the habits that you are comfortable with, the shared stories, values, the beliefs about the outside is what people are comfortable with. And so even within a large company, the HR folks are very herd-like. They all talk the same language. They dress very similarly. They work in similar patterns. The marketing folks are very different from the HR folks, and they all think and see things in a particular way, which is why they often have problems with the sales folks, who have their own style. And the poor HR folks are supposed to hire people who fit the culture of today, while the culture of today is changing. And so the complexity of the herd should not be underestimated, which leads me to the whole discussion of Google. And the engineer who writes a 10-page opus about why women are more anxious and unable to fit into the tribe, the herd.
Yeah.
And the reactions to the 10-pager, some were soft. You know, he's entitled to have his difference of opinion. And others were, this is disrespectful and it's out of the core values of the herd. And I'm not quite sure whether the herd wants diversity as long as it fits their values, or it only wants real diversity, or whether what he did was so out of the realm of what is heard, accepted, and the tribe really rebelled. It's just fascinating. In today's conversation, a little like Uber, where the herd was run by somebody who really had a different attitude about women. Somebody asked me in an article they were writing about, why is it so hard for women to break into that herd? And in part, it's politics. You know, if you own something like the guys do in the tribe, often it's hard for women to break in. But I'm finding a lot of women now forming their own tribes. And 30% of the business in America now is owned by women. And they're building very different businesses. And that's the topic of my next book.
So there's so many layers to this that I want to dig into. So my first question is, which is the concern I honestly have for myself, is how do I know when I'm just following the herd? Because it happens, doesn't it? And I, you know, sometimes I see it on Facebook in particular, where someone posts something that is against the herd mentality, and the you know, responses come flooding in, even though maybe they didn't even read whatever that person fully wrote. It's just on the surface, right? It is against the grain. So yes. How do you know when you're doing it? How do you avoid it? What is the impact of it? Let's take it to that deeper level of, okay, this is happening. Now what? And, you know, to your thing with the guy that wrote the Google, I don't know if you call it a manifesto. I'm not sure exactly what the right word is for the document that he wrote. But, you know, were we so mad at it because it's against the kind of what's accepted conversation right now? Or are we mad because there's truths in there? Or are we mad because he's a jerk and what he said was mean, you know?
Well, maybe it was all of those, but let me go to your first question. Yeah. Is should we be glad or sad when we're following others? And I think you have to be kind to yourself, because you're most comfortable talking to others who make you feel like you know what you're talking about. You know, you and I share a common background in ethnographic work, and we're talking not as strangers, but as folks who have had similar experiences. And people live in groups for a reason. It gives them safety. It reduces risk. It makes every day a pleasant one. They know how to dress. They know what to brush their teeth with. I mean, there's lots of good reasons for becoming part of something. Now, the second part you said is that when something disagrees with that herd, you know, do we push it away or do we become open-minded about it? And it's very hard, because while we believe we have free will, I must tell you, the habits in the brain take over and we're predictably irrational. We buy things with the heart. It's a heart-head person, and it's how it feels first, and then you will justify it with the logic that comes out of your thinking. And so this is, you know, for this gentleman at Google, I have a hunch there was something very emotional in what he was writing, just because that sounds like the power that was coming out and the reasons he were giving were very feeling ones. It was how he felt and why he thought that women were different then and couldn't therefore be part of. The logic, I'm not sure there was much to it, but who knows? I mean, did he have 5 case studies, 1,000 case studies, no case studies, an experience, one? And so if everything is heart to head, then the question for you as you're thinking this through is, which group shall we belong to that we're most comfortable with? And where are we outliers? I mean, this gentleman at Facebook who was told he wouldn't have a good performance review because he supported the president. Now, that's an interesting outlier.
Yeah.
Whose now career and job is being influenced and impacted seriously by this. And we're no different than other societies. You know, if you know, go to the highlands of New Guinea, there was a lot of cannibalism. They fed off each other. They killed each other. They fought all the time. They had a very small mountain space, and they went on expeditions with, you know, spears to go to war. And war was what we played. And it's been going on for thousands of years as humans expanded, and they go to war. And this is a cultural war, and the herds are just not very happy right now.
So, yeah, it's a culture war is exactly what it is. But I would, you know, I think my thought to the listeners out there and what you're saying about the challenges of the herd is, you know, what I love to tell people is, okay, you don't have to agree with whoever about whatever, but take a step back and at least dig a little deeper and have some understanding first before you come to judgment. You can be as judgy as you want at the end. I don't really care. But I want you to actually have an informed judgment, not an informed judgment of the surface of it, which I think sometimes is the challenges of the herd. But let's take it back to kind of what, you know, we're talking in the beginning around success, performance, innovation. How do we think about the herd when we're trying to innovate? Do we need to leap out of it to innovate? Can we leverage the herd? How does this fit together?
Good question, because if you're going to change your organization, you need to be very intentional about to what and how. I often get calls from HR directors. They have a new CEO. Could I help them change the culture? They've been asked to change the culture. And we use tools, but the question is to what and how. So going back to your question here, we have a well-established tribal society. It's global. We have thousands of people everywhere, and we are going to become more innovative, or we're going to empower them more, or we're going to change the way in which they get work done. And that is really words. I have no idea what that actually means.
Yeah, right. It's lip service. Right? Yeah.
It is. And we're going to become innovative is a classic. We work with one company.
We're going to think outside the box.
Yes, we're going to be more innovative. And everyone wanted to be more innovative and collaborative. This was a company where the CEO signed every check. It was a little controlling. And so this is both behavior and what you value. So I want to make that point, because it isn't just abstract culture, the symbols and the stories. It's also actually how we get things done. We're going to be more empowering and innovative. And I said to them, okay, give me a story about what you do today that's not innovative and very controlling or bureaucratic. And they could tell me that. I said, okay, now we have to visualize what this will be like when you become more innovative, empowered, visionary, and so forth. So give me a story about that. Silence. I said, okay, you got to tell me we're going to move from the CEO signing every check to, you know, will managers have budgets? Will you be able to make decisions about how you're going to treat customers in new ways? We work with Starbucks up in Canada, and we spent a day talking about doing just this, becoming more innovative and collaborative. And it didn't go very well, because they call their numbers in every day.
Wow.
And how innovative are you going to be making a macchiato? And, there's got to be aspiration on the one side, but a realization that, you know, what are we going to become and how are we going to do it? Now, I said to you, it's both behavior and what we believe in, because for important reasons, remember, we buy with the heart and justify with the head. Until we visualize what it is you would like that to become, I don't know how to make it happen. And we work with a cement manufacturer down in Mexico. They too wanted to become, there's a movement there, partly because they couldn't hire anybody. Young people didn't want to work in a bureaucratic, factory where everybody had their silos and nobody teamed up. And they finally said, okay, let's focus on collaboration. I said, good. Let's talk about what will be more collaborative. Again, we had silence. So, you know, this is about, I really don't know what that means. I've never worked in a place that was more collaborative. It sounds like it's something we should aspire to, but how will we make it happen? And as you begin to work with people, it's really like learning a new game of golf. I give you a club and a book and you're supposed to hit the ball. It doesn't work that way. You have to hit it lots before you get going. So anyway, I hope that helps explain the process of change and how we go about it using lots of storytelling, visualizations, and helping people make new decisions about how they will get things done.
Well, I think you've given us a lot of tools to think about and a more anthropological mindset, if that's the right way to say it. And I would encourage listeners out there, if you do one thing, there's so many things to do out of this, but if you do one thing, go and observe for a couple hours and take copious notes about what you're observing, what people are saying, what they're not saying, what you're seeing, kind of the step-by-step process. It really is, I think, one of the most powerful tools out there for innovation and just having a much better perspective on, you know, what it takes to get your job done and the jobs around you done. I can't even believe we're out of time. So I want to make sure I get this in. You had mentioned your book and you had mentioned workshops. So just talk a little bit about title of your book and where to get it. And same with the workshops and where to connect to learn more about those.
Tamara, how kind of you. The book is called On the Brink, A Fresh Lens to Take Your Business to New Heights. It's available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Hudson News. It's both in Audible, ebook, and hardcover. And it is full of both stories to share, because I like stories, and tools to use. And it will help you both see how you can do it, but also others have done it as well. And it is very humbling because you realize you're not alone. And if you're stalled, it's a great time to begin to figure out how others have unstalled, and you could as well. We do tons of workshops. I've got 30 booked for next year. You can reach us at info@simonassociates.net. And our website is simonassociates.net or andysimon.com, which is for the book. But we love to hear from you. We also have a podcast. The podcast is On the Brink. And you can listen to some of them, subscribe. They're all full of tools you can use, case studies. And a little like tomorrow, we like to have conversations. And on Fridays, I do an Ask Andy podcast. So send me your questions and I'll help you with the answers.
I love it. So that's great. So go find those things. The last question I have for you is, what's one thing people would be surprised to learn about you? It can be hobby, passion, experience.
One. Oh, how interesting.
Only one, Tamara?
Only one thing. You know, Tamara, our biggest love in life are horses. And my husband and I have had horses at home. We fox hunted for 25 years. We've ridden in Africa twice, Argentina and Peru. My daughters were all competitive horse people and excelled at it. My granddaughters all have their ponies. But the passion we have is the way animals help you observe and begin to realize that it's so much more than just about us, and we find that they are just special creatures, and we just love horses. So that's part of my passion.
I would not have guessed that. So well played. Not what I was. I don't know what I was expecting, but it wasn't that. Andy, thank you so much. I've learned a ton out of this conversation. I feel like I've got some actually great to-dos this next couple of weeks. So thank you.
It's a pleasure. You're a great, great interviewer. I truly appreciate it. Thanks so much, Tamara.
Thank you.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.